Hello and welcome to Atlantic Brücke's new dialogue format, the Transatlantic Call. A little bit of delay today. Welcome all of you. My name is David Eisner. I'm the Executive Director of Atlantic Brücke, and on behalf of our Chairman Friedrich Merz and Atlantic Brücke, I would like to welcome all of you to the second edition of this new audio format. And these 30-minute conversations, we would like to give you regular first-hand insights into a variety of transatlantic topics and debates. The conversation will again be held in English, and you can dial in or hang up at any time. To ensure a fluent conversation without external noise on the line, the audience will be on mute, and we are recording this transatlantic call, and you will have access to the transcript later on our website. Some of you have already sent us some questions beforehand, and we will try, of course, to consider all of them in the following conversation. Our second transatlantic call is entitled Democracy and Participation in the Digital Age, and it is my great pleasure to introduce our very special guest in today's call, Mr. Alec Ross. He's currently running for governor of Maryland, and moreover, Alec Ross serves as senior fellow at Johns Hopkins University. He's the author of the New York bestseller, The Industries of the Future, which deals with ways of seizing digital expertise in the modern knowledge and technology society. Prior to that, Alec Ross had served as senior advisor for innovation to former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Alec, welcome and thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm also delighted to welcome the moderator of today's call, Mrs. Kirsten Rolf. Kirsten Rolf is fellow for Artificial Intelligence, its Ethics and Governance at the Harvard Law School. She focuses at Harvard not only on AI, artificial intelligence, but also on other emerging technologies such as autonomous driving, the Internet of Things, and more broadly on cybersecurity, cyber conflict, and technology policy. Kirsten just graduated in May from the Harvard Kennedy School as a McCloy Fellow with a Master in Public Policy. Prior to her time at Harvard, Kirsten has worked as a political news correspondent for German national TV news Tagesschau. And of course, Kirsten is a Young Leader alumna from 2012. Welcome to the call. And with that, I would like to hand over to you, Kirsten. Let us start the conversation.
Thank you very much, David. Also from my side, and good afternoon, everyone here in Germany, and good morning to those of you who might be joining us from the United States. As David said, my name is Kirsten Rolf, and I'm currently a fellow at the Harvard Law School. Today was supposed to be my first day back at work, but please bear with me and many apologies in advance, because in addition to some interesting insights from the conference that I participated in last week, I also brought away with me a nasty flu. So I apologies in advance for any coughing and sneezing on my part, but I think we will have a very interesting half hour, especially because I'm very confident that our guest this afternoon, Alec Ross, is much fitter than me. Alec, thank you for joining us. Some questions have reached us for this call from Atlantic Brücke members, and they will all be asked. But let me start with a topic that I think is close to both of our hearts. Alec, you grew up not 4 hours' drive away from Charlottesville, the town that we all now sadly know, and you're currently campaigning in Maryland, which is even closer to Charlottesville, just about a 3-hour drive, I think. And the events there have deeply shocked most Germans and Americans, but sadly not all Americans, maybe not even the president. And given our topic, participation in the digital age, those people that keep propagating white supremacist views utilize the internet and social media very much to distribute their alternative narratives. Just to give one number here, a project by the German Marshall Fund just found 600 Twitter accounts alone to promote just one hashtag concerning Charlottesville and the events there. And those are the same social media networks that spread Russian propaganda during the 2016 election. Alec, you are an expert in social media campaigning from your time with Secretary Clinton as a senior advisor on her campaign. And you're currently campaigning for yourself also online, and very excellently, I might say. So from your experience, can you tell us the two top strategies to stop these alternative, these alt-right narratives on the internet?
Sure. So number one, I would say is I think that the platforms actually have substantial responsibility themselves. So I think number one is I think that people from government and from civil society need to insist that platforms like Twitter, like Facebook, monitor very carefully who it is is using these networks and whether they are doing so surreptitiously and for the purposes of manipulating the information environment in a way that is malignant and which violates the terms of services of the platforms. So the first thing I would say is there is a responsibility for all of us to push these platforms to be much more responsive than they have been in the past. The second thing, I think, is we have to name and shame the purveyors of this activity. It's very difficult sometimes, particularly on Twitter, which allows for anonymity. And I think that to the extent that people who are orchestrating these bots, to the extent that people who are protagonists in some of this white nationalism, they have to be identified, they have to be named, they have to be shamed, so that there's some consequence to their actions.
Thanks. Let me take you up on both of these points. Maybe the latter one first. As I said, mainly these bots have also spread Russian propaganda. There is some suspicion that they might actually also be controlled, maybe from a foreign power, maybe Russia, just saying this very carefully. You say naming and shaming the purveyors, but how much sense does that make if they're actually not individuals, if they're not in the United States, if law enforcement in a particular country cannot actually get to them?
Well, if that is the case, if it is, say, the point of origin of attack is from Macedonia, but receiving instructions from Russia, which I think is frequently the case, then I think that you have to engage diplomatically. And this is a case where, honestly, the United States is unlikely to do so because we have a president who is sympathetic to the extremists. So for other countries who, you know, still believe in, you know, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, I think the key is to put real pressure with consequences on the actors behind it. You were very careful saying, you know, maybe from Russia. I don't think there's any need to say maybe. I don't think there's any need for conditional language. I think it's been established beyond a reasonable doubt that the Russians are seeking to destabilize Western democracies. The problem is that people give Vladimir Putin and the Russians some stern words, but that, you know, a scolding does not have a great effect on him. I think it is time for us to begin to hold Russia to account for molesting our democracies.
So this is actually a follow-up question from an Atlantic Brücke member, Alec, from Foreign Office speechwriter Simon Vogt, who sent us this question prior to the call, but it actually fits very nicely here. Given that there's also some anxiety here in Germany, in Berlin, with the upcoming general election in just about 4 weeks, can you share a little bit about your own experiences, maybe from the campaign trail, how you, as a politician, can make yourself less vulnerable against such attacks, maybe not just from a technical point of view, meaning not just doing the obvious, ramping up cybersecurity?
Well, I don't think there is anything you can do as an individual candidate. I think that it really is the responsibility. So beyond the technical things, and every candidate, every political party should do what they can from a technical perspective, but the responsibility is really on the nation state. To make clear that there are consequences if there is foreign interference in the election. So, for example, with your election on September 24, I think the best way to keep the Russians from molesting that election is to let them know through public channels and through private channels that if there is evidence of their doing this, then there will be severe sanctions. And I know Germany, for example, you know, oftentimes has mixed emotions about sanctions. But if you aren't willing to say, no, we won't buy your oil, no, we will not engage in commerce with you, then you make yourself vulnerable. So I really think that the responsibility is on the nation state to make clear what the consequences are.
That's a very strong statement there. Recently, Sami Sarah, from the vice president of the Observer Research Foundation in New Delhi actually demanded also compulsory social media participation from citizens in elections, and particularly in such polarized policy issues as we're discussing right now. If we just disregard the logistics of that, which are obviously complicated, do you think that that's also something that citizens should be held more responsible in any formal kind of way for online for their own online participation?
No, I think that I think the things that are compulsory are anti-democratic. People should have the freedom to engage and the freedom to not engage.
And you think that's not contrary to your first point that you made, namely that we should all hold platforms more responsible for monitoring their own...
So let me just make sure I understand you. So what you were saying is that citizens had compulsory social media use? I'm sorry.
That's not what I'm saying. That's an idea by Samir Zaran.
I think that citizens have to hold social media platforms to account, but I think saying that all citizens must do something as a compulsory law-mandated thing is itself anti-democratic. No. So, and I don't think it contradicts itself. There's a difference between saying citizens should hold platforms to account and making it a law or regulation that citizens will use social media.
What do you think about the new German law that holds, for instance, Facebook accounts via a mechanism for the content that they publish?
I think I am not sympathetic to the German law in this respect. I think that the most effective response to offensive speech is more speech. I think that as long as what is being published does not violate Facebook's terms of services, then I think people should be free to publish it. And I think the idea that 196 sovereign nation states could have 196 different sets of laws to govern a single private sector platform, I do not think makes sense. And I think it's inconsistent with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that allows for the freedom of expression. Freedom of expression allows for the freedom of offensive expression as well, I believe. And while it may irritate me, I do not believe that platforms should be regulated in terms of the kind of content that is there so long as it does not incite to violence.
Okay, so the naming and shaming that you you mentioned earlier is more sort of a moral holding accountable than more enforced.
And an economic holding to account. So with the naming and shaming, for example, people, the marchers in Charlottesville, the most effective means for shutting them down in many respects has been putting their faces on the internet, making clear that they were marchers. And what happens? Their employers fire them. What happens is they go home and suddenly everybody around them hates them for being white supremacists. So, the naming and shaming, I think, is both moral and economic. It isolates people. I think you need to isolate people societally.
Okay. Let me ask a question from another Atlantic Brücke member, if you don't want to add anything. I think it ties in nicely here because it regards the role of political parties and their social media and other online presences. This member noticed that, especially in Europe, populists from the far right and the far left use technology, such as social media, more effectively than other big parties. He gives the example of the populist right-wing AfD party here in Germany, and he says that they have almost as many Facebook followers as other parties in Germany combined. You're obviously very experienced in this. What can mainstream parties do to improve their use of social networking sites?
So the first thing I think they have to do is they have to be willing to take a bit more risk. A lot of these nationalist far left and far right parties are not afraid to engage rather in a rather overt, forward way with citizens, where the more formal, longstanding parties do so in a way that connects with people somewhat less effectively. And it's in part because the tweets or the Facebook posts read like press releases, as opposed to something that's more like a town hall or a conversation. So I think that if you want to connect mainstream political parties with the governed more effectively using digital tools, then you have to maximize the use of the tools to be able to connect and get directly and in a way that is a bit less formal. So using things like Facebook Live for live video chats, speaking in a way that sounds more like people speaking on the street than from behind a lectern wearing a white shirt, a red tie, and a pinstripe suit. These stylistic differences matter greatly as it relates to connecting with younger voters. I also think that mainstream political parties have got to confront the nationalist parties, the far right and the far left parties, when they are putting out fake news, when they are saying things that are factually inaccurate, or if they are doing things that are rooted in racial or ethnic bigotry. I think that we cannot be polite in responding to them. And we have to confront them. And part of how you can confront people most effectively is doing so through social networks.
So how do you confront the president best then on social media?
I don't think, look, Donald Trump has proven to be almost immune to being confronted on social media. Where he is confronted, just because of it, it's where he pays attention, is cable TV. So I don't think he pays any attention to what people say about him online, maybe just because he can't even work his phone except to send a tweet. But you can see him in an absolute rage some days because of what he watched on the morning talk shows or what he read in the newspaper. So the way to confront Donald Trump is actually not on social networks. It's through television and the newspaper.
So if you were to, as you did with Secretary Clinton, if you were to advise Angela Merkel, you would take sort of a two-tier strategy. Definitely improve on the social media side, becoming less formal, but also just don't move away from the traditional media as she's doing right now. I mean, being as present in the formal media as she's doing right now. What did you take away from the 2016 election campaign for your own campaign right now?
You know, it's a recognition that people are angry. And non-elites who have suffered from economic stagnation have to understand and value the perspectives of people who have been stagnating economically. I think that there is I hold the belief that in the states, Democrats have failed somewhat recently because our elites are segregated from sort of the working class. And so I think that we've got to reconnect ourselves to the working class in a way in which we have not done for many years.
You have always been very optimistic about the role of technology when it comes to that reconnection and also reintegration of maybe more vulnerable populations into the workforce. In your book, The Industries of the Future, as far as I remember, you prove and you outline the thesis that digital competencies like programming languages are really the key when it comes to reintegrating or integrating vulnerable populations into the workforce. Could you give us maybe three priorities that a future German federal government must tackle to ensure that particularly vulnerable populations are not left behind?
Yes. So first, I would say, is an issue of access. You have to ensure universal access to high-speed, low-cost broadband. That's number one. Number two is skills training, and skills training in all schools, not just the elite schools in wealthy communities. I believe that computer code is the alphabet that much of the future will be written in.
making sure that young people, and it's not about everybody becoming a computer scientist, but making sure that people are fluent in the alphabet of the future is very important. And the number three is a focus on gender. Too often women are underrepresented in technical fields, including computer science. So I think it's worth it making an extra effort to ensure that the interest of women is sustained, particularly after young girls entering adulthood when their engagement on technology tends to wane.
Maybe just as we're actually already getting to the end of this call, you're currently running for the governor of Maryland. You're doing so very successfully. The election is 2018. Can you give us an example from your own constituency on how you're trying to bring these three things together, or how you will try to bring these things together in the future?
You know, it's hard work, but as somebody running for office, the most important thing I think is to remember you only have one mouth, but you have two ears. So instead of just going into the room and talking, really seeking to understand the perspectives of people. And oftentimes, what I've found is that you can disagree with somebody, but if you understand why they think what they do, then you can find common ground. I think that becoming a good listener will make you a better talker. I also think that where I've tried to use social media and Facebook in particular is instead of arguing with people, is asking them why they think something. And then instead of responding and telling people that they're wrong, just putting a series of facts in front of them in a way that isn't meant to humiliate them, but in a way in which it's sort of tries to bring them to the truth of a matter without it being overly confrontational.
Great. And I think that's as far as my watch says is already pretty much the end of our call and our time here together. Alec, thank you very much. This went by very, very quickly, at least for me. There were many more questions that I would have liked to ask, but we got through all of the questions of the members. So I hope they are all satisfied with this. This was the second transatlantic call with the topic democracy and participation in the digital age. Thank you all for your insights. I learned a lot, and I hope that all of our members out there enjoyed listening to us as well. My name is Kirsten Rulf, and with that, back to David Deissner.
Thank you so much, Kirsten, for this very thoughtful and carefully prepared and inquisitive interview. Thank you so much for moderating this call. And Alec, thank you so much for taking the time. I know you are a very busy man. You're in the middle of your campaign, and we very much appreciate that you took the time to join us here for the Transatlantic Call. We talked about accountability, about responsibility for citizens, for corporates, responsibility of the government in the democratic process, and how to deal with extremists and their presence and visibility in the social media space. Thank you so much for sharing your views and your perspective on these.
It was my pleasure. It was an honor.
Thank you so much, Alec. And again, to our listeners, I would like to raise your attention to Alec Ross's book, The Industries of the Future, which was published with Simon & Schuster. And also to Alec's website, which is alecross.com, Alec Ross for Governor, if you would like to find out more about Alec's work. Again, thank you so much. Thank you, Alec Ross. Thank you, Kirsten Rulf, for moderating this call. And I'd like to invite you all to our next transatlantic call. We haven't fixed the date, but the next call will probably take place in October. And we are very much looking forward to receiving your feedback. Just send us an email to Atlantic Burger. Thank you so much, and have a good day. Thank you. Bye-bye.